God is good all the time. Do you ever lose something of great value to you and search and search and search and search and search, and finally you find the place where it ended up? You know what that feeling is like? I mean, it depends on how important it is, but there's some documents that I've lost a couple times, and I dug and looked and searched and all this. Man, it was just so good to finally find that thing. I just breathed a sigh of relief. I apologized to all the people around me that I had accused of being messing with my stuff, and apologized for anger and all that kinds of thing. But it was just such a relief and such a joy. And I'm thinking of a time back in 2004. We had had a Halloween hayride out at our house. Jonathan would have been about a year and a half, maybe not quite two, but a year and a half old. And he's in the story here, and that's why I'm mentioning that. But we had a hayride out at the house for the teens. It was a memorable time. I remember it was a hayride in the rain. And John Gamp brought his tractor and trailer over, and we had a guy named Dave Picklesheimer that had hauled his tractor over, and we had a trailer we'd borrowed for the hayride. And he didn't want to take his trailer home Saturday night. He said, "I'll just come back on Monday and pick it up." And he left me the keys, and he parked the tractor over in the yard, and he left me the keys to the tractor. He said, "I'll be back on Monday." Well, I had those keys in my pocket when I Saturday night. Sunday I got up, those keys still in my pocket, and I said, "Well, I better put these where they'll be safe. I don't want to lose these things." And I laid them on the dining room table, corner of the table, in the front room on Sunday morning. And I came back from church that afternoon and noticed halfway through the afternoon that those keys had disappeared. And that was a matter of grave concern to me. I started asking around. Nobody knew anything about the keys. And at that time, as I say, Jonathan was about a year and a half old, and he was the only guy that we couldn't get a straight answer out of. Okay. Where's a year and a half old? I don't know what kind of answer you expect anyway, but we talked with him. As near as we could figure, Jonathan had taken the keys and done who knows what with them. And he was fascinated with keys at that time. If you had a set of keys, he wanted to hold them and play with them and carry them around, and we'd bought him a little set of plastic keys to play with and to kind of distract him. But we searched that house over. We had put Jonathan under the bright lights, and nothing was coming up. Finally, we gave up, and on Sunday evening, I knew I had to call Dave Picklesheimer about the fact that I had lost the keys to his tractor, and he would have to bring another set if he was going to get that tractor moved. And I told him, "I'm embarrassed to have to say this, but I've lost the keys. I have no idea where they are. We've looked this house over. I just do not know where they are." And Monday morning, got up, had a little bit of breakfast or something, and for some strange reason, I go out the back door onto our porch. And there's a big pile of stuff on our back porch. And it was a Jonathan pile. There were clothes there. There were pillows. There were stuffed toys. For some reason or other, he got it in his head that he was going to take everything that was his and hide it out on the back porch. And when I started messing around in this pile, this Jonathan pile, lo and behold, there were the keys. And it just felt so good to be able to find the keys. The world was right again. So how do you feel when something valuable is lost and then you find it? Well, we rejoice. It's just as natural as rain for us to rejoice when we find something like that. To do anything else would just be unnatural. I can hardly imagine being upset about it. But we're happy. We rejoice. In Luke 15, Jesus is criticized for associating himself with tax collectors and sinners. And he's criticized by the scribes. It says the scribes and the Pharisees were the ones who were doing the criticism. Well, Jesus didn't like their attitude. And he told a series of parables that had to do with the natural response to finding something of value if it's been lost. In every case, the parable emphasizes the joy of everyone once the lost thing has been found. And so you have a shepherd who finds his lost sheep. And when he finds his lost sheep, he rejoices, and everybody who's his friend rejoices with him. And then there's a woman who loses a valuable coin, and she sweeps her house and finds it. And when they find the coin, everyone rejoices. They all get together and have a party because they found the coin. And then there's a father who finds a lost son. And when the lost son comes home, everyone rejoices. Father throws a big party. Everyone rejoices, except one guy. We're going to talk about him in a little while. But the father finds his lost son, and everyone rejoices. And Jesus told these parables to rebuke the critical attitude of the Pharisees. And that's the main point. No matter what thing Jesus did with the lost, ministering to them, helping them, whatever it was, no matter what Jesus did, the Pharisees could always find something that was wrong with what he was doing or something to be upset about. And Jesus points out to them, he said, "No, you need to be rejoicing when the lost are found." And so we're going to talk about from Luke chapter 15. If you want to turn in your Bibles to Luke 15, everything is going to come from there, or almost everything, and you can look at these verses while we talk about them. But I want to look at the parables, not from the standpoint of the idea of rejoicing. I want to look at these parables and ask a different question. This is not a question that we often ask. And that is, how do the lost end up being lost? There's a sheep, there's a coin, there's a son. All of those people, all of those things are lost, and they're all lost in a different way. And I think there's something to learn about the lost and about our role in helping them if we understand how they got lost. The first parable is a parable about the lost sheep. This is Luke 15, verses 3 through 7. So he told them this parable, saying, "What man among you, if he has 100 sheep and has lost one of them, does not leave the 99 in the open pasture and go after the one which is lost until he finds it?" Now, let's stop and say something about verse 4 here. This shepherd has not run off and left 99 sheep all by themselves and gone off to find the one. It's not that they're out in the middle of a field wandering around while he goes and looks for one that's lost. The way this thing worked was there were common folds or common sheep pens that were located in various fields. And so I have no doubt whatsoever he took care that the 99 weren't just wandering around. They were in the sheep pen. But he's got one. When it came time to count these sheep as they went into the pen, he realizes that there's one missing. And so he puts the 99 away, and he goes after the one, and he's looking for them. And so he does not leave the 99 in the open pasture and goes after the one which is lost until he finds it. When he has found it, he lays it on his shoulders, rejoicing. Verses 6 and 7. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and his neighbors, saying to them, "Rejoice with me, for I found my sheep which was lost. I tell you that in the same way, there'll be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who need no repentance." And so there's the parable, the first parable Jesus teaches about how natural it is for someone to rejoice when something which is lost has been found. But my question is this: how does a sheep get lost? What is it? What caused that sheep to get lost? And the answer is this: it's his own carelessness. You have to understand what sheep are like and understand their nature in order to understand how the sheep got lost. The sheep didn't get lost on purpose. It just wasn't paying any attention. It got preoccupied with the next clump of grass. It ate over here for a little while and over there for a little while, and there was another clump over there and another clump over there, and give that sheep 2 or 3 hours and he's a half a mile away. And they have poor eyesight. And so when he finally thinks to lift up his head and look at something besides the next clump of grass, he has no idea where he is. He can't see 50 feet away. And so he's lost. And he's lost because he just wasn't paying any attention. Lost because of his own carelessness. And I think it's interesting that in the Bible, the Lord often refers to us as sheep. And it's really not a compliment that he calls us sheep. I hope you understand that. It's kind of like we're very careless. We wander around. We get ourselves lost. And we're about as helpless as sheep. But in Isaiah chapter 53 in verse 6, this is where the prophet is talking about people. All of us, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way. We all one saw a clump over there and one a clump over there. And pretty soon the whole flock is scattered out. But the Lord has caused the iniquity of us all to fall on him. All of us like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned his own way. So sheep get lost through their own carelessness. And the same is true with people. People don't usually decide to get lost. They don't usually set out to get lost. They just kind of end up that way. They get so busy, so focused on the next thing that they have to do, the list of things that they have to accomplish in this day, all the stuff that's got to be crammed into the day or the week or the whatever. They get so focused on those things that they lose sight of where they are. They lose sight of something, of the thing that may be absolutely critical, absolutely essential for eternity. Most of the stuff that we get absorbed with, those clumps of grass that's here, there, and everywhere that lead us astray, most of them are not wrong. Most of them are good things. There's nothing wrong with our jobs. There's nothing wrong with sports or the PTA or the Scouts or band or Kiwanis or karate or 4-H or Weight Watchers. There's nothing wrong with family gatherings, birthdays and anniversaries and parties and vacations and all this kind of, nothing wrong with any of that stuff. It's all good. But even good things can crowd out the things that are of supreme importance. And sometimes they do. And so we need to take stock regularly. We need to lift our heads from the next clump of grass and look around and think about where we are. And we need to understand that's why we have shepherds. The Lord has designed often we're referred to as the flock. And there are shepherds over the flock. There's a reason why the Lord has given us shepherds. And when the shepherds come looking for us, you may not understand. You're wandering away. You're lost. You need to listen. But that's why the Lord has given us shepherds over the flock. Back in 1985, I read something in the paper that totally amazed me. I couldn't believe that this happened, but it was in the paper, so you know it has to be true. But there was a skydiving team club in North Carolina, and they decided that they were going to make a special formation. There were about 20 or 25 people in this club. And they all got together and decided they wanted to make a special formation in the air as they dived, and they wanted to get it on videotape. And so they figured out exactly what order they were going to jump out and how they were going to maneuver. You can maneuver in the air, you know. I mean, you can actually slow yourself down. You can speed it up. You can move laterally if you know what you're doing as a skydiver. These people did. And it turns out that they fixed their design, figured it all out, and they had a guy who was pretty good with video stuff. He was kind of a techie sort of guy as well as a skydiver. And they gave him the job of having the camera and doing the filming and all that. And he was the first guy to go out. And then everyone else comes out and they get into the formation. And he is there. He's the one that's going to do all the filming. So comes the day of the big jump, the formation and everything that's going to happen and the filming of it and all. So the guy who's in charge of this, you know, is checking his camera out, make sure he's got plenty of battery. Camera, everything's working fine about the camera. Got the lens cap off. You know, I'm not going to mess myself up that way while I'm diving from 15, 20,000 feet or whatever. Don't want to do that. Make sure he's got a tape in there and all that. Got his jumpsuit on, got his boots on, his helmet on, everything that he needs to have in order to make a really high-quality video of this special formation his buddies are going to make. And so it all happens just like that. He goes out first, and then there's about 20 people who follow him. They come, they link up the way they want to be, and they fall through the sky, and he's videotaping. And he's actually able to move around some and catch various angles. And then it comes time for him to put his camera away. He turns it off, and he reaches for the ripcord on his parachute. And there's no ripcord because there's no parachute. You know, if you're going to make a video of your buddies as they fall from 15, 20,000 feet into formation, make a nice video, it's really important to have your camera ready. And it's really important to have a battery. And it's really important to make sure you got your little tape cartridge in there. It's really important not to have the lens cap on top of that. And it's really important to all this stuff is all of it's important and all of it's good and all of it's necessary if you're going to make a really nice videotape. But for God's sake, don't forget to put on your parachute. But that's kind of how we are. That's who we are. We're so very careful about all the little things that we want to cram into life. But the one thing, the thing of ultimate supreme importance, is sometimes the thing that people just goes right on by. They don't even think about it. Some people are lost through their own carelessness. They're just not paying attention. There may be a lot of things important for you to do in life, but when you come to the end of your journey, the only thing that's going to matter is, do you have Jesus Christ? Now there's a second parable. That's the parable of the lost coin. This is found in verses 8 through 10, Luke chapter 15. So Jesus tells this one. Or what woman, if she has 10 silver coins and loses one coin, does not light a lamp and sweep the house and search carefully until she finds it? And when she has found it, she calls together her friends and neighbors, saying, rejoice with me, for I have found the coin which I had lost. In the same way I tell you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. So Jesus tells another parable. He says something valuable has been lost. And when the woman finally finds it, everyone rejoices, everyone's happy. But here's the question. How did this coin get lost? Well, the coin is an inanimate object. The coin is not like the sheep. The coin can't be careless. The coin is lost not through its own carelessness. The coin is lost through the carelessness of someone else. Someone else was careless. Maybe it was the woman of the house. Sometimes people get lost because someone else was careless. Someone else wasn't paying attention to what they were doing. But it has a profound impact on them. And they become lost because of someone else's carelessness. This is the situation in 1 Corinthians chapter 8. When Paul is writing to the people of the Corinthian church, and you have to understand this is a mixed church. There's Jew and Gentile converts in this church. And this is primarily a controversy that come up among Gentiles about how they were going to... how they're going to deal with the issue of food. What was okay to eat? And some of those Gentiles thought it was A-okay to eat food which had previously been sacrificed to an idol. And some of those Gentiles thought it was not. And the Jews are like their own case. There was no Jew who would even consider being involved with meat sacrificed to an idol. They were so far over here on this side. It was a controversy among the Jews, but it was affecting the whole congregation. And it was especially affecting the Jewish people here. They were divided on this thing. And there was someone in this congregation who was being very careless about food. Of all things. They were being careless about food. And this issue had become so intense in this church that there were some people who were in danger of losing their souls because of how someone else was dealing with the issue of food. So Jesus, I've put this up here, 1 Corinthians 8, 8 and 9. You could read all of this and it would make more sense. But Paul makes this comment. He says, food will not commend us to God. We're neither the worse if we do not eat, nor the better if we do eat. But take care that this liberty of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. And so Paul is just pointing to the fact that, you know, don't be careless. Be careful about how you're dealing with this issue of food, because you can damage some people. You can hurt some people. Every Christian ought to have their eyes focused on Christ. But unfortunately, some Christians, and I say this especially for young Christians, don't have their eyes so much focused on Christ as they do on other Christians. And what they see and what they hear can very easily become a stumbling block for them. And so we need to be careful, because some people are lost due to the carelessness of other people. Then there's a third parable. This is the parable about the lost son, or sometimes we call him the prodigal son. And I'm not going to read all this parable to you, but I hope you remember the story. If you don't know this story, you're not reading your Bible enough, and you're not coming to church enough, I'll tell you that. But it's the parable of the lost son. And it's about a farmer, a very successful, good farmer, who has two sons, an older and a younger. And the younger son becomes dissatisfied living at home with dad and his brother. And he decides long before his father passes on that he wants his inheritance. And he asks for it, and his father reluctantly gives it to him. And that boy takes it, and he goes off to a far place. And for a while, man, he's living high on the hog. I mean, it's parties and all this kind of stuff. And riot. It uses the word riotous living. So we know some questionable things are happening here. But it goes like this, and pretty soon his money runs out, and all of his friends are gone. And there's a famine that hits the land, and he's fallen on hard times in this faraway place. He looks around for a job, ends up getting a job with a Gentile pig farmer, working for the pig farmer, feeding pigs. Now, this is a pretty low job for a Jewish boy to get. And there comes a point. This is chapter 15 and verse 17. There comes a point as this boy is feeding these pigs one day, And he's so hungry himself and just barely getting by on what he's making from this job. It says he came to himself. Or he came to his senses. And he said, you know, the hired servants that work for my dad back on the farm, they've got plenty to eat. They've got it so much better than what I do. You know, I'm going to go back to my dad, and I'm going to say to him, Father, I've sinned against you and against heaven. I'm no longer worthy to be called thy son. Make me as a hired servant. Just hire me on, but don't treat me like a son. I don't deserve it. And so the boy does go back. He says those words to his father, and what does his father do when this happens? He runs out there before he gets even up the driveway and puts his arms around him and kisses him and puts a robe on him and a nice ring. And he said, go kill the calf. We're going to have a big barbecue. We're going to have a big party here. And he's rejoicing that this lost son has finally come home. And that's what the parable is about. But here's the question. Why was the younger son lost? It wasn't through his carelessness. It wasn't that he just wasn't paying attention and ended up lost like a sheep would. And it wasn't that somebody else was careless. He had a good home. He had a good place to live. It was a good situation for him. And he turned his back on that. But he was lost because he wanted to be lost. He planned it. He chose it. He knew exactly what he was doing. He knew who his father was. He'd been treated well by his father. He knew where his home was. He knew the way home the whole time when he was in that faraway country. He walked the road that got him out there. He could walk the road that came back. He knew the whole time. It was his decision, his choice. He was lost because he wanted to be. I think it's fair to say that some people are lost because they want to be lost. They've chosen that. Somehow or the other, they don't like that home with God. They want to go somewhere else. It's just too restrictive. Or there's something about it. There's some reason they've got a grudge against God. I've run into this several times in this particular area and in other areas too, where someone who's an adult, maybe 30, 40, 50, 60 years old, and the question comes up, well, you know, why don't you come and visit with us? Why don't you come to church? He said, no. Not coming to church. My dad made me go to church every time the doors were open when I was a kid, and I hated it. And I swore that when I finally got up to where I could, have my own home and make my own decisions, I would never go back to church again. I run into that quite a bit. And there they are, 55, 60, 70 years old. And they've spent their whole life proving that no one can make them go to church. And when I run into that, I say, you know, don't you think you made your point? That no one can make you... I mean, you spent the last 50 years proving that no one can make you go to church. Why don't you do something for yourself now? Why don't you do something that would be in your own interest? Just make a decision. Because actually, I said, your father is still controlling you. You're still just reacting to what he did. Why don't you make a decision that makes sense? Because you've made your point. Why don't you do something that will help you in eternity? Quit licking the wounds of the past. The point that I'm trying to make here is there are some people who are lost because they've chosen that. They've chosen to be lost. It's their plan. It's their intent. So we need to pray for them that they might come to themselves like the prodigal son did. When we read Luke chapter 15, we generally think of Luke 15 as being about three lost things: a lost sheep, a lost coin, a lost son. But actually, there may be four things that are lost in this parable, or in this chapter. There's actually a fourth parable. It's about the lost, I'll call him lost, older son. And I want to read these words to you. Luke 15, 25 through 32. Now his older son was in the field. There's a big party going on back at the house, and the older son's been out in the field. That's what he always did. He was a hard worker. I mean, he always did what his dad said to do. Good boy. His older son was in the field, and when he came and approached the house, he heard music and dancing. And he summoned one of the servants and began inquiring what these things could be. And he said to him, your brother has come, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he received him back safe and sound. But he became angry and was not willing to go in. And his father came out and began pleading with him. But he answered and said to his father, "Look, for so many years I've been serving you, and I've never neglected a command of yours, and yet you've never given me a young goat so that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who's devoured your wealth with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him." And he said to him, "Son, you've always been with me, and all that I have is mine. But we had to celebrate and rejoice, for this brother of yours was dead and has begun to live. And he was lost and has now been found." Now, it may be a stretch to say that the older son is lost. But I think we can at least say this, that even though the older son had never left home and always been there with his dad, there were a lot of things that were not right in his life. And the thing that signals all this is the fact that he can't rejoice when his younger brother comes home. That's the thing that just lets you know, boy, there's some bad things going on here. Inside of this young man, I can see pride. I mean, he's a good worker. He's out in the field, always doing exactly what his dad told him to do. But I see a lot of pride in him. I see some selfishness and some jealousy. I see bitterness. I see an unforgiving spirit. I don't see very much love at all. And all of these things kept him from rejoicing when his brother came home. Now what Jesus is actually doing is he's describing the Pharisees to themselves. Jesus did this fairly often. He's just telling this sweet little story about a father and a couple sons and all that. And on the skin of it, that's all that's going on. But Jesus is actually pulling their chain. And they know it. And they can't do anything about it because on the surface of it, it's just a little story that Jesus is telling. He's not pointing at them. He's not saying, "Hey, you're the guys." He's not doing that at all. But the Pharisees know. The disciples know. Everyone knows. The scribes know. They all know. Jesus is tweaking their nose. He's pulling their chain. Because he's saying, "You know that older son, the one that can't rejoice? That's exactly how you are." Pharisees could not conceive that God would be anything but happy with them. They were the religious elites. They were models of righteousness. If anybody was going to go to heaven, they would be the ones first in line. But it was clear to Jesus that there were some serious problems with the Pharisees and the scribes. And that's why they had such a rotten attitude when he tried to help people, like the tax collectors and sinners. And so through this parable, Jesus is describing the Pharisees to themselves. Well, here's the question. Why was the older son lost? I mean, he's not like the sheep. He wasn't lost through his own carelessness. He wasn't paying any attention. And he's not like the coin. He wasn't lost through someone else's carelessness. That's not the problem. And he's not like his younger brother. He's not lost because he wanted to be. It isn't like he just made a decision. I'm leaving home and I'm going to just go do what I want to do. That's not the kind of person he was. Why was the older son lost? He's lost because he never addressed the issues of the heart. Somehow he lacked the courage and the capacity to ask himself the hard questions. He lacked the honesty to look inside and ask himself just every now and then, "Who am I really? And what do I really want to do with my life?" There's some huge lessons here for us as individuals and also as a church. The first one has to do with forgiveness. When a brother or sister in Christ confesses and repents of their sin, all of us who have been forgiven by Christ, and I think that would be just about all of us here, all of us who have been forgiven by Christ must also forgive them. That's certainly in the parable here, isn't it? We may never forget exactly what happened. We may never forget the hurt or the time or the event or whatever it might be. And we may have to make some adjustments going forward from that time. But we can't use the past to beat up and to hold down the person who's been forgiven, who's come back. That's one lesson. Here's the second one. It has to do with rejoicing. When someone who is lost finally comes home, it's time for all of us to rejoice. And if joy is missing, that's a little sign. That's a little red flag that goes up. When joy is missing, we need to become concerned about ourselves. We need to start asking ourselves, why aren't we rejoicing? Why doesn't it matter to us? Why isn't it something to get excited about? And there's different answers to that. I don't want to go into all that. But when someone comes and confesses Christ and becomes a Christian, or when someone, a Christian who's been caught in sin and enslaved in sin and been in the far country, so to speak, and comes back, when they come back and we don't feel joy, we're not rejoicing about that. There's a little red flag that goes up, and that brings us to the third thing that needs to happen. We need to start asking ourselves the question. There needs to be some self-examination. We need to ask the hard questions. 2 Corinthians 13:5 says, "Examine yourselves to see whether you are in the faith." The Bible teaches us to ask ourselves hard questions, to examine ourselves, to not just go to the next clump of grass and never look up, but to look up and figure out where we are, and to make sure we can see the shepherd, you know, not get so far away that we lose track of the shepherd. But we're taught this in the Bible, to examine ourselves. Two times, we ask every person here to examine themselves. Two times every Sunday. The first time is in the Lord's Supper. In 1 Corinthians 11:28, as Paul's talking about the Lord's Supper, he says, "Let a man examine himself, and so eat of the bread and drink of the cup." And so when you listen to what Paul is saying here, before we partake of that cup, it's a time for us not just to think about the Lord and what the sacrifice he made on the cross. It's also a time for us to think about, you know, what's going on with me? What is my relationship with the Lord and with the rest of these people around me? It's a time to ask that question. The other time that we ask people to examine themselves is right now, the time that we're going to sing an invitation hymn. And so we've put the Word of God before you this morning, and I'm asking you to apply it. I'm asking you to do that little self-examination thing, to look up from the clump and look around and see what's happening. And it may be that God is prompting you to step out, to confess your faith. If you're not a Christian, that's the first thing he wants you to do. And when you examine yourself, am I a child of God? Am I a Christian? And if you're not, you need to do something about it. You need to become a Christian. And maybe God is prompting you to step out. You're already a child of God. But he wants you to confess your sin and the weakness of your life and ask for the prayers of this church. We're going to sing our hymn of invitation right now. If there's anyone here this morning that needs to respond to the invitation of Christ, we ask you to come. Please come to the front.